Laser Blast.
Hi, you're listening to the Laser Blast Film Society podcast, or as other people like to call it, Laser Focus. You guys promised you wouldn't do that anymore. My name's Justin DeClue, and I'm here today with
Matthew Kumar,
Dan Gorman,
Nate Wilson.
And today we watched a Lee Marvin double bill with Point Blank and The Emperor of the North. So the first one we watched was Point Blank, the classic John Borman-directed film where Lee Marvin plays... His name wasn't Parker, which is based on the Richard Stark novels. It's this one specifically being the hunter. His name was it Walker?
Walker, yeah.
And where Lee Marvin plays a professional criminal who gets backstabbed on a job, and then he just wants his money. That's the whole plot of the movie. Now, contrary to what usually happens in Laser Blast Film Society, I had seen this movie because after last week's debacle of Day of the Dolphin and Ishtar, I wanted to pick something that was going to be good. So I picked Point Blank for a Lee Marvin double bill. But Matthew, you hadn't seen it before. What did you think of it?
I actually think it's the best movie I've seen in ages and ages. For a variety of reasons. First of all, actually, what I think is interesting because going into it, because I just, you know, Lee Marvin, crime film from the 60s. I guess I just assumed it was just very straightforward, you know, because when you describe it, he just wants his money. You're like, all right, so he beats some people up and he goes and gets his money, right? But no, from like the very beginning of the movie, like before the credits where it comes upon Point Blank, it's like really, you're like, what is...
It's like a Nick Rogue film.
Yeah, you're like, what is actually going on? And I was like, I don't understand what's happening here. But then from that point on, it's like a crazy dream sequence sort of like of a movie, you know, like
it makes me wonder the way that it's edited. Is it like, did they decide to do it that way? I read a story that when John Borman made the film that they had the script and they're like, the script sucks, and they're like, we're gonna try our best to like figure out how to make this movie good. And if that's something that they did while they were shooting, or is it a decision they made in post-production? I was watching the film pretty closely to see if there was anything that was like that they had to shoot it on the day to get that kind of effect. And there isn't
really. It's a lot of editing. Yeah, because there's that, like the whole scene at the beginning when Lee Marvin's walking and it has like, he's walking down that like that hallway with like the wide angle, and it's like a really awesome shot, but it's just like nothing but the soundtrack of his shoes on the marble, and it's intercutting with her at home. Like, that's totally something they could just be like, let's do it this way.
And the walking builds and builds and builds.
And finally, like, when it meets up, though, and he's, like, at the house and the footsteps stop, it's like, holy shit. That's so good.
I remember reading, though, that Walter Hill, when he was getting into screenwriting, that he read the script of Point Blank, and he's like, wow, this is how you can do screenplays, and that inspired him to do his first movie, which I believe is called Hard Time. The one with Charles Bronson.
Yeah.
When did Point Blank come out?
67.
67?
Yeah. That's like, I guess that's kind of when like movies were starting to get like, it had to be kind of a little bit different.
Well, I mean like the French New Wave.
Yeah, maybe by like bad, like the script was bad. They just meant the script was more typical. And they wanted to make it more, you know, exciting. Yeah, exactly.
So I looked up because I was just interested in this. Yeah, it's 67, right? And so that's like the same year as like Branded to Kill, for example. Mm-hmm. So it's just like clearly that period of time where Point Blank.
I always make that mistake.
I don't like Point Break very much, but we can talk about that in another time.
on the Point Break podcast.
The Point Break podcast. Point Blank. Mm. Like is interesting to me because it does feel a lot more like one of those contemporary Japanese crime dramas, because they're always so much stranger and more stylistic and much more clearly inspired by the French New Wave.
Like a
Nakatsu movie, basically,
like the later ones,
like for example, Branded to Kill, which is like at the extreme end of that. But then there's stuff like, you know, my cult is my passport and stuff like that.
Yeah. Well, it definitely feels like one of the reasons I came to Point Blank is I originally wanted to do like a noir double bill, and I was going to pick like a classic noir and like a neo noir, and Point Blank was one that just came up on my radar. And it's interesting because it's come so far after the noirs happen in Hollywood. While like the Nakatsu stuff, like Branded to Kill and stuff like that, is a reaction to having to work in those constraints. It's like, let's make it just really fucking weird because let's just do something different. When did Bonnie and Clyde come out?
I was gonna say
69.
Yeah, because I was gonna say it feels like it's like you're saying it's after all the noir stuff, but it's like right at the beginning of New Hollywood, right?
Yeah, so that's like what I thought it was.
It feels it was New Hollywood.
I don't think this one ever gets put into New Hollywood kind of stuff because it's. I don't think it was technically a Hollywood pick. Well, I guess it was Lee Marvin. It was made by.
Like it.
Yeah,
it feels a little like it.
But, and John Borman was one of those guys after that. Like he proceeded to become one of those directors.
Yeah, and I mean John Borman was always a huge cinephile. He actually started a great book if you get a chance to read it that was published yearly called Projections, where they would get like filmmakers to write articles. Like Joel and Ethan Coen would write a diary about making like Raising Arizona or something like that. And it's something that really doesn't get talked about enough. But yeah, John Borman is definitely a film fan. You can feel that when you're watching the movie.
Yeah, and I mean, I read a little bit after we just watched it, but apparently it's very much a very close collaboration between John Borman and Lee Marvin, and you really get the sense the film wouldn't work without Lee Marvin in the role, because there's a scene, like, it's really one of the early scenes of movies where I was like, this movie's amazing, because Lee Marvin's, like, he's just like, caught up with his wife, and he has to basically get the information out of her. All he does is sit on the couch, and she just goes, just starts... just basically saying a bunch of exposition at him.
And he doesn't say a
word. He doesn't say it, he just sits there. And it's like, this is amazing, because, well, they obviously knew that having him do all this stupid bullshit where he's like, where is such and such, blah, is a waste of everybody's time. So he had to do it, make it seem really awesome and cool. I'm just sitting there. And apparently it's because when they were filming it, Lee Marvin had all these lines, and he just sat there. And she was like, okay, so I'll just keep saying my lines.
Is that what actually happened?
Yeah. So, that's amazing. So they were like, and apparently John Borman was like, yes. This is the right person for the role. This is perfect. This is exactly how the scene should go.
Where Lee Marvin is just really drunk. Yeah. And like,
I didn't know we were rolling. It's like, it's like, oh.
Well, it was, yeah, there was a point where I was like, what would this be like? Like, did they try to cast anybody else in this role?
It was like Frank Sinatra in the main character.
Yeah. Lee Marvin apparently was attached to it from the beginning. And because Lee Marvin was like a star at that point, the studio were like, I can't exactly how it went, but something like director, like final cut and everything, they were like, Lee, you get to say what goes with all this stuff. And he was like, all right, John Borman makes all the decisions. And they were like, okay, I guess so. So that's why John Borman had like final cut and stuff. Because when the film, obviously when the studio sat down to watch it, they were like, we should reshoot a bunch of stuff, add a bunch of explanations.
Yeah.
And they just didn't get their way, you know, in the end.
As Nate would say, it would be really weird if it was someone else, because Lee Marvin and like the character of Parker has been regurgitated like a million times in pop culture since Point Blank came out. The movie Full Contact, directed by Ringo Lam, starring Chow Yun-fat, is supposed to be an adaptation of a Parker novel.
Really?
Yeah, that's how far like it's gone out. And I mean, like Jason Statham just started.
Does
Parker...
always just take revenge? Is he always?
That's
like...
what it seems
like.
Because
that's
what Full Contact is.
Yeah. Because in Parker, it's like he gets burned on a job and then murdered, and then they leave him for dead or something.
Well, there's actually the best adaptation of the Parker novels beyond just reading the books. Darwin Cook, the comic book artist, did like adaptations of the book, like very, very literal adaptations of the novels. And his Parker character is just a professional. Like, he doesn't care about people's feelings or anything like that. He's very slick. While Lee Marvin's performance in this movie is more like, he's more like a lummox. Like, he's not... dumb.
No, but there's a weird man-child quality to him. Like,
well, I mean, it's like, as late, we said, especially late in the every movie. Single shot that is just concentrating Lee Marvin, just imagine he's going, where am I? Because it always makes sense. Because you look at him, he just seems confused as to who he is. But having said that, I think that, like, the movie's interesting because, like, it is very much like an early example of that character who's just... he just has complete control of the situation. At no point are you ever thinking, stuff's going to go wrong for him here.
Yeah.
Like, even if people are going to attack him, you just know he's going to know what to do.
Yeah.
You know?
Even at the end where, you know, spoilers if you haven't seen the movie, where the situation doesn't go the way that he technically wanted it to be, he just takes a step back and doesn't get involved.
Because it is very much like one of those, like, essentially a classic like revenge fantasy film, basically, where you're just watching someone expertly just battle through all of his enemies, but in a bizarrely understated fashion. Like, there's a sequence in the middle where he's essentially casing out a building where she's like, you'll never get to the top of this building. And in a modern film, even watching this, I was desperate to happen. The character would go, all right, and he'd just fight his way to the top of the building without taking a hit. Do you know what I mean? But in this, he does it in a I guess.
He just distracts them.
Yeah,
and
he literally just walks in, which is even cooler. Because he just basically goes, I will just create a distraction and then just walk back. There's a part where he's just standing behind them.
Yeah.
Well, it feels like John Borman is, going and undercutting all the expectations you have.
Yeah.
Like, there's a scene where he's in the parking garage and you think a gunfight is going to start. And then suddenly the villain, the police show up and they just take him off.
Yeah.
And there's a long sequence of the villain being like, ah, my leg! No! No, he's over there!
Yeah. At the same time, though, Borman, like in the, when you said undercutting expectations, he also does a thing where he doesn't show you stuff that, mm-hmm. like, other movies would show you. Like, 'cause there's a whole thing about him getting to the top, and then, like, it just cuts to him at the top, and he's already tied up a bunch of people. Like, you don't see him, like, get up to the top, get noticed, tie those guys up, like, disarm them. Just, like, it's, like, almost like a gag cut. It cuts to the top, and he's already got them tied up. So, like, when you're saying with the character being kind of, like, boorish or whatever, mm-hmm. it's also, like, yeah, you know that whatever comes his way, he's probably mm-hmm. going to figure it out, and he doesn't even need to show you that.
You see one, like, real mano-to-mano fight, and it feels like the movie's going, you know what he can do.
Yeah.
Like, we don't need to show it to
you.
Well,
they go out of, it goes out of its way to show that he's not really, like, a reactionary character, right? Mm-hmm. Like, he's with the woman, and she's, like, slapping him in the face and stuff, and he's just standing there. Right? Like, he's almost, and you said, like, he backs into a way. Mm-hmm. He's almost just like, let me see how all this turns out, and then I'll figure out what to do.
Weirdly, though, like, this has become the movie that people remember Lee Marvin for.
Yeah.
Like, in a lot of ways, it's weird that the one that's, like,
well,
playing...
and the Dirty Dozen, I think, are the two. When you think of Lee Marvin, you think of those two movies.
Yeah. I just mean, like, as far as, like, crime movies that he's in, it's weird that the one that's, like, playing with your expectations, and that's actually, like, really playful, is remembered oftentimes as being, like, a super just straight crime movie.
But as I said, it sticks with him for almost the whole film, and he's such a force in the film, even if... if you're looking at it with sort of a silly mindset, he looks confused the whole time. Like, he's just almost always in shot, and anytime he's not, like as you say, like, he doesn't show you certain things.
Yeah.
But, like, the film by Borman is so carefully constructed that every shot has really, really carefully positioned in terms of coloring. Yeah. Like, so, like, I was watching it, I kept, like, thinking, like, what does the strong colors of the women's dress mean?
You mean the yellow?
And yeah, she wears yellow, and
the
then
walls
red.
And,
then she wears red, and then there's, like, she's lying in bed, and then, like, actually, towards the end of the film, John Berman, like, starts to, like, hammer it home almost too much, because you start to get into the mindset of the film, and you're like, I know exactly. So she'd be lying in her center, maybe like, oh, just like his wife.
And then it cuts to
the way. But you're like, I already got it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But, like, and, like, even just careful stuff where, like, frames the shots, you just immediately are like, there's pills next to our bed, and he, like, knocks them away. Like, all that stuff's really good. But then towards the end, he's like, I'll keep cutting back in case they haven't got it, which is, like, kind of a bit of a shame almost.
Yeah.
Because at the beginning, you're completely confused, but at the end, you feel as in control of the movie as Lee Marvin is, you know?
I think it's just probably the studio being like, hey, could you... And when you're doing something stylistic like that, you do want to kind of hammer it home at the end. Like, this is the climax. Look at how it is.
Yeah, maybe John Borman had an even more, like, polarizing cut.
What would it be? Like,
I don't know.
We were talking about John Borman when I mentioned him as a filmmaker. He's a weird filmmaker that never, like, entered the mainstream in a way that even, like, Arthur Penn did with Bonnie and Clyde. Like, when you go to someone, he's like, you know, like, John Borman. They'll be like, who?
Yeah.
Which is funny because he did have a lot of movies.
And he had a lot of chances to enter the mainstream. Like, Zardoz is a big, big, like, budget movie.
Well,
and
Deliverance, that's his most famous.
No, Deliverance is probably
the most popular. Yeah, but also,
no one knows that it's John Borman.
He got a chance to make Exorcist 2.
Oh, let's not forget.
Fucking crazy. And
I mean, in both of those films you've just described, like, there's this chance to enter the mainstream. A film where, like, Sean Connery is wearing, like, a G-string and then Deliverance is a movie about, like, you know, not hobo rapes, but, you know,
but
I mean,
Deliverance,
like,
is, I think, did give him the opportunity to make Zardoz because it was so successful. They're like, what do you want to do next? You know, you have the Golden Touch and Excalibur.
I was just thinking, like, I know that Deliverance was critically acclaimed but also derided at the time. I've read some reviews at the time where people are like, this is just, like, a violent fantasy and, like, not a classic at all. So but it did really well, obviously.
Yeah, but I think and at this point, like, it's considered a classic.
Oh,
you
like
mentioned, like, dueling
classic.
Banjos.
Yeah.
It's entered the pop culture mainstream in a way.
Yeah, the banjo thing is gags in, like, action movies and
shit.
It's
it's one of those films which is, like, it Deliverance makes me think of Misery, for example, because it's so much about the period after you've gone through something terrible. It's about the thing that remains afterwards. Yeah. So it's always, once you've seen the film, all those jokes don't seem very funny.
Yeah, exactly.
Unless, you know, you find that kind of stuff amusing. Yeah. And we've been so desensitized by the internet and stuff like that.
Misery's pretty over the top. Misery's weirdly, maybe it's just because it's shot by Barry Sonnenfeld.
Is it shot by Barry Sonnenfeld?
Yeah, it's pretty.
Well, I guess
it's a little.
But he's talking about like the general theme, not the way that the movie.
It's a little Raising Arizona.
I
don't, like crawling across.
Yeah,
the
I don't think the movie's very good, but the book really stuck with me. Even though I'm not much of a Stephen King fan, but if we're gonna talk about desensitization, I think we could easily move on to Emperor of the North, because I can't imagine what it would be like to go to the cinema in, like, what, 73 or something?
Yeah, 72, 73.
Can I describe just the opening?
Plot? Yeah, no, let's talk about what the plot is. So, I had heard about this movie. I think that the first time I heard about it was when Ernest Borgnine passed away, which I have to point out that he had the best Q&A I ever saw at Fan Expo, where he had so many stories to tell that when they had to, like, take him off, he was kind of like, well, it's just one more. I just got one more story to tell. and I had never... It has such a crazy plot synopsis, which is that Ernest Borgnine is the captain, they say, of a train.
Yeah.
The number 19 that no hobo can ride, or as Ernest Borgnine likes to call them, bows.
Yeah.
And any hobo that rides the train gets their just desserts, as Nate is very excited to explain in the opening.
Oh, well, no, it's just the whole movie is like a weird... I mean, we'll get to the plot later, but like the whole movie opens with this like almost like cartoony thing of like a hobo climbing onto the train.
We have to explain that there's a song as well at the beginning.
Oh yeah, it opens with a song that we described, that I described as like the opening to a Mel Brooks movie, so over the top, cheesy, and saturated.
Yeah, so the point is, the setup is, it's like 1972, you're like a teenager or whatever, and you're like, I guess I'll see this movie about trains.
No, you're a boy with his mother.
A boy with his mother.
Yeah, a boy with his mother. I'll see this movie about trains. I like trains. Trains are pretty cool. It's still the 70s. People like trains in the 70s. You know, they haven't... you sit down.
So,
hobo gets on the train.
Hobo gets on the train and Ernest
Borgnine... He's eating a sandwich?
He's eating a sandwich.
He knows that the hobo's there, and he grabs his hammer and he walks over to the train and he just starts whacking him with the hammer. And the guy's like stuck in between the two train cars, and he just falls through, and we see like a long prolonged shot of him under the train tracks as the train goes by
over
and
him,
he, like screaming in pain, and then finally as the train passes by the canvas, we turn and we pan down, and there's just two parts.
The guy's like buried up to his...
The guy, his legs on one half of the train tracks and his torso and the rest of his body on the other half.
And then the credits continue.
And the song comes back up and more names of the cast.
And there was a text crawl at the beginning too. Like in the land of hobos and trains.
Yeah,
like,
there was a king of hobos.
It's like we're going on a fantasy adventure of some kind.
I feel like a lot of kids saw this movie in the theaters with like their dad. Like their dad was just like, oh, Lee Marvin and Trains is gonna be like a violent kind of like dudes movie.
And so the movie is about Lee Marvin plays the king of the hobos, a number one.
That's his name.
And basically the plot is just he wants to ride that train and to get, you know, for some reason, just like to show Ernest Borgnine, and there's a little tramp hobo but played by Keith Carradine who wants to tag along. Actually, as Matthew said, more like a jackass hobo, played by Keith Carradine.
He's a very unlikable. Well, he appears because him and the child we never see again, and another hobo we never see again, are attempting to steal a chicken from
Lee Marvin.
From Lee Marvin.
Which Lee Marvin proceeds to beat them with the chicken.
Which the chicken survives, which I find so interesting.
Like eight beats.
He lashes that chicken for like 20 minutes because he jumps on the train and then he jumps off the train.
Yeah, he jumps on the train. He doesn't just jump off the train. He sets the train on... Basically, because Keith Carradine's character is a moron, his name is Cigarette.
Self-proclaimed.
Self-proclaimed Cigarette, who likes to tell tall tales about how awesome he is.
Yeah.
He basically gets A number one and himself trapped into a steer car. Of which A number one had skillfully got into, but of the keys carrying messes up, which requires A number one to set the train car on fire and then jump through the broken wood holding a chicken,
laughing maniacally.
Yeah, laughing maniacally to escape.
We've seen a long range of like Lee Marvin roles.
Yeah, long range. Really, you mean like a... Lee Marvin is much more enthusiastic in this film than he was in Point Blank.
Yes. Yeah,
and he's playing like a completely different character. In the sense that he's angry, barking, he likes to monologue a lot.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of weird because it's kind of like, it sets you up. What I didn't want to have, because it makes you see Keith Carradine and you're like, fuck this guy sucks. but you obviously know what's going to happen is he's going to take him under his wing and he's going to try and teach him. What it turns out is this movie is a Rocky V. It's... You know, it's not gonna.
What is it? Machine Gun. What's the name of the bat?
Joe?
No. In Rocky V, the guy he trains.
I can't remember. The guy turns him in the end, right?
Yeah.
I haven't seen Rocky V in years. but anyway, that's. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that happens.
Yeah.
Basically,
basically, Keith Carradine is you could say riding Lee Marvin's train. He's basically like, okay, Lee Marvin's gonna try and ride. Ernest Borgnine's train that he doesn't want anyone to ride, and then Keith Carradine's kind of like riding the coattails of Lee Marvin. He's like, I'm going to kind of like usurp his... He kind of wants the spotlight, right?
Yeah.
He's just going to be like, I'll show him, I'll do it too. So it's like hobo versus hobo, and both of those are versus Borgnine.
But it's weird because like it's kind of a hard movie to understand the whole kind of context or themes of, right? Because it's set in the Depression.
Geography.
Well, it's set in the Depression, but we also haven't mentioned the fact that Ernest Borgnine's character is called Shaq, which becomes very confusing if you just keep thinking about Shaq.
Yeah.
So you have a difficulty of associating like famous people's names with other people.
Don't you?
No.
Particularly people that are like one name. Like if Ernest Borgnine's name in this movie was Prince, let's say, I'd have kept thinking of Prince, right?
And you said that you think that Shaq, the basketball player's parents, named him after the Ernest Borgnine character in Emperor
of the North. It's entirely possible.
They just love those trains.
And then we kind of got into some like racist musings of a street smart remake of this movie taking place on subways.
Yeah, called starring Shaq Emperor of the South Bronx.
I thought we were going to leave that.
Yeah, I'm really unhappy that you
Don't
brought
say
that
the
up.
Hose part.
Yeah, we have to cut this part. Jesus Christ.
Hey, we got Neil LaBute to direct.
Yeah. It's true, yeah. He's a very sensitive, non-misanthropic human being. But I've completely lost my train of thought.
Oh, you were having difficulty
of thought?
Oh. Yeah.
You were having difficulty separating Shaq and Shaq.
But that's not really where I was going with it. Just like the whole kind of context is that, you know, Ernest Borgnine really, really doesn't want bows on his train, right? But no one else respects him for this. Everyone hates him.
Yeah, nobody's a big fan of him.
Like, no one is like, Ernest Borgnine, you're a hero of mine because you respect your job.
But we also haven't really explained how, like insanely cool Ernest Borgnine is. He, like, has, like, certain weapons that he's really good with. He has, like, a costume that he's always wearing, like a big black outfit.
He has his hammer. He has
a chain,
and he also has some sort of a metal rod thing that he uses by throwing under the train, because hobos often hang onto the bottom of a train, and it just sort of bounces about and, you know, hits the hobos, and they die, I suppose. I mean, we really have no idea how many people Ernest Borgnine has killed, but...
I assume hundreds.
Yeah, I assume hundreds also, but because people dislike him so much... I feel very sorry for him. And in fact, there's a scene later on where a perfectly ordinary policeman, just trying to do his job in the Depression, where, you know, it's hard to keep your job, right? Not everyone's getting paid. All these hobos, like, take the piss out of this
policeman,
and the policeman looks scared because he's surrounded by hobos. And I'm like, are we supposed to be on these fucking hobos' side at this point?
Yeah.
Like, I understand it's Depression. I'm not saying get a job, bows, or anything, because obviously it's hard to get a job. But I'm just saying, like,
get a job,
be nicer to people who have jobs. I mean, he literally says, I'm just doing my job.
And then they make him drink grease.
And then they make him drink grease, because apparently in Bowland, grease is good for fucking everything.
Everything. You can put it on your wounds to cauterize your wounds.
You can use it to stop trains.
Exactly.
Yeah.
There's many layers of Wile E. Coyote and Roadrunner.
Yeah.
Like, everybody gets a chance to be Roadrunner in this movie.
But we don't want to talk the movie up too much either, because as we pointed out, there's like 40 minutes where they jump off the train and get fucking baptized out of nowhere.
It's not that long.
But yeah, that was really weird. I went to the bathroom and I was like, what's going on? And they like steal everybody's clothes.
I think it's always one of those movies where there's like, it's mostly gray area. You know, you're not really supposed to be rooting for anyone because the baptizing scene has a really weird sort of sexist joke, as far as I can tell, which is, the first person we see getting baptized is a woman in white, you know, cloth with nothing underneath. And then for the whole time, Lee Marvin, who's also getting baptized for some reason, I guess to distract them while they steal their clothes, which doesn't really make any sense.
But there's so many people getting baptized.
Yeah, they're distracted anyway.
It's a pretty subtle joke that Lee Marvin says the whole time staring at.
He's just like, I'm just going to look at this woman's chest. And then he's like, have you sinned? He's like, yes, I sure have sinned. Wink, wink, looking at the tits.
I'm sure that was just like the decision where he was just watching TV and not saying anything. I'm sure it was a decision that Lee Marvin made on the set.
Yeah, he's like, I want to get baptized and I want to look at some tits.
You could cut this movie. I think this is a 2-hour movie. You could cut it down to like a real lean hour and a half hobo versus train guy movie.
And you could make it so they never get knocked off and you wouldn't even know.
No, you wouldn't notice. And also, the whole point of this movie is, we're going to ride this train and people are going to bet on whether we're going to make it to Portland or not. And then at the end of the movie, instead of it being about like whether or not they're going to be able to stay on the train or not, they just fucking like basically almost murder Borgnine. Like, when does it?
I have to say that they murder Borgnine.
Like, when does it become, oh, we're going to try and get on his train and he's going to try and kill us and we'll fall off the train and stuff? Like, when does it become like, oh no, we'll just kill him now?
They kill him, but then they put in some ADR being like, I'll be back!
It's a G.I. Joe, like, the movie type of thing. Where it's like, oh, Duke's still alive!
Don't worry, Optimus Borgnine will return. It's a movie that gets to a place where you're kind of like, what is happening now? Because they get on and off the train, and then in the end, basically, Ernest Borgnine and Lee Marvin get into a death match in a ring on the back of the train, where they attack each other with chains, an axe, pieces of wood, while Keaton just sort of watches. But it's like a fight that makes less sense than like the fight in They Live. Do you know what I mean? Like, put on the glasses. Because it's a fight to the death over you're not allowed in this train. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Or I would like to be on this train. You know, like.
But it's a metaphor, Matthew. I don't know what
class struggle. It's a class struggle.
But it's
metaphor.
Not even it's not like if we like cut to Borgnine while they were scrabbling in Hobotown for the turkey. To Borgnine, like, sitting, eating, like, delicious food and being like, I love being the train guy.
No, he never shows any, like, evilness except for just hating hobos.
Maybe he was like, I used to be a hobo.
Yeah, or he's
that was our theory. It's like Snowpiercer, and then at the end...
At the end when, like, Lee Marvin...
Spoilers for the train now.
They were gonna...
Spoilers for Snowpiercer. But if it ended, it was Lee Marvin killing Ernest Borgnine. And then Ernest Borgnine
would be like, you killed the hobos now.
You don't have a choice. Yeah. Or, like, Midnight Meat Train.
Yeah.
Which is exactly how that
is. I mean, like, if they're gonna...
Yeah, it totally does.
I mean, if they're gonna chuck in ADR to make it seem like Ernest Borgnine's still alive, they could have chucked in some ADR earlier on where Ernest Borgnine just goes, a hobo killed my wife. You know? Something like that. So, but then, again, I already sympathize with Ernest Borgnine because he was just doing his job. He did. But the thing is, I sympathize with him despite the fact that at the beginning of the film, we watched him murder a hobo in cold blood.
You know what it was? It was like a test screening where like one person just loved Ernest Borgnine.
Yeah.
And it like didn't matter. Like he was like, let the Ernest Borgnine kill the hobos, but he better not die at the end. He doesn't need a reason to kill the hobos. And they just said that and the studio was like, put in some...
But Ernest Borgnine's not just doing his job. He'd probably do a better job by not focusing on the hobo stuff and getting the train to where it's supposed to go. He's like, I'm just doing my job driving this train. Also, I'll take like 5 hours off to kill these hobos.
But then, as established in the ADR, he's like, a hobo ate my dog. And like, that's it. Like, set up. You know, we know why he does it. You know?
But if he did
he's like Michael Myers.
So
he's
like the Redux Matthew Kumar cut of Emperor of the North. He's like, a hobo did what? Ate my dog.
Yeah.
Killed my wife. One of my children is a hobo.
A hobo once wrote a nasty letter to me.
But then he wouldn't be as good. He'd be like a villain, like that. We would be like, if a hobo killed you, I'd be like on his side even more.
once a hobo said a swear and I heard it. Like, I should kill all hobos.
So as this finishes up, I don't think we have anything else to say about Emperor of the North.
It's bizarre.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, really, I don't know if I don't know if I'd recommend it.
Yeah,
but
it's not something I'd be like, you need to see Emperor of the North.
It was really fun watching it with some friends.
Oh, and yeah. The interesting, we did forget an interesting, another piece of interesting trivia, which is that Lee Marvin's character is called A Number One, mm-hmm. which is something said to the King of New York in Escape from New York, which Ernest Borgnine is also in.
And
so
we looked at IMDb, and somebody already wrote it down in the references section.
John Carpenter himself.
Yeah, we say that John Carpenter, because he's not doing anything these days, yeah. other than playing video games and watching basketball, updating his own IMDb page.
Yeah.
Smoking a little bit of weed, being like, we want him to get that Emperor.
He was watching Escape from New York, and he's like, I'm so clever.
Yeah.
That's so weird that that's like the one reference they would put in Escape from New York as a reference to Emperor of the North.
And then Carpenter's like, I gotta go make another IMDb account to upvote The Ward.
I don't think John Carpenter likes The Ward. That movie is terrible. As we finish up and we did our Lee Marvin night, which we probably won't do again, does anybody else like Lee Marvin? Does think of a role that they know him in, or Ernest Borgnine, when you think of those two actors? Because I was looking on IMDb when I was like, I should pick another Lee Marvin movie, and I'm like, I don't know which one to pick, because it's not
really good.
Prime Cut is really good. Prime
but
Cut
he,
is
he
like
plays the exact same character as like Point Blank.
Yeah, but Prime Cut is like the poor man's Point Blank, where it's like it's really weird but doesn't have that like editing scheme that Point Blank has, but it's also directed by Laser Blast favorite
Michael Ritchie,
the guy who directed Digstown.
The
Michael Caine's The Island?
The
I haven't seen that one.
What's the Golden Prince?
Oh, I hate that movie. That Eddie Murphy one? Yeah. That everyone, when they talk about it, they're like, it's like Big Trouble in Little China with Eddie Murphy. There's some fun stop motion.
I tried to watch it. I was like, got like half an hour into it. And I was like, I don't really like this.
This is boring. Anything that springs to mind, Matthew?
For Lee Marvin?
Or Ernest Borgnine?
Well, for Ernest Borgnine, and everyone's going to be like, Matthew, come on.
Can you watch more Ernest Borgnine movies?
It's got to be Basketballs.
Yeah.
Oh, perfect choice.
Come on, because he's joyful in that. He's joyful in that. And I love that movie. Like, we were talking about, like, last week, probably not on the podcast, we were talking about, like, Zaz films that we enjoy. And I'm like, you know what? Fucking love Basketball.
You know what? I really like Basketball. Me and Pierce Dirks, who, may he rest in peace, he's in the other room.
dead, but he's in the other room.
He's in the other room. Dead.
No one said anything, and I'm like, I have nowhere to go from here. is we watch Basketball, not as funny as I remember it being. Because when I was a kid, that was the funniest movie of all time.
You have to watch it with a lot of people. You can't, like, don't watch Scary Movie 3 without a lot of people. Don't watch Mafia without a lot of people.
I watched Scary Movie 3 by myself the first time and found it hilarious. but yeah, I guess Basketball is a really good choice for an Ernest Borgnine profession. I mean, if you want to go really classic, you can go with Marty, because didn't he win an Academy Award for that one?
Yeah,
that's a
I
really
mean,
easy choice.
Doesn't, just to talk about Basketball some more instead of an actual movie, doesn't Ernest Borgnine like take his top off and saying, I'm too sexy, while rubbing his nipples? Like, I mean,
can't go anywhere.
You can't
that's
really
just,
go
that's
anywhere
great.
From that, you know, like,
is there a Lee Marvin type performance like that? I mean, Paint Your Wagon, but like the creator of The Simpsons, I don't think any of us have seen it.
No.
So. And that story about that Simpson episode is that none of the writers had seen it, and they were like, we're going to write songs of what we imagine the movie is supposed to be like. All right, well, if nobody has anything else to say, I guess we'll close this up. It's weird that we did one where there was two movies that one that we really liked and one that we kind of liked.
Yeah, well, one was brilliant,
yeah,
and one was like, I feel like it is kind of a you gotta see it movie to tell people to watch, but at the same time, it is 2 hours and there is a lot of details.
It's less like a movie I want to recommend and more just a movie I want to like tell people that I watched.
Yeah.
Tell people about watching
it. You could totally get away with just watching it for the beginning, the song, and then the last fight. And you'd be like,
that last fight is great. And it's kind of sad that there's nothing else like that that you can recommend. Is that you'd have to be like, it's a crazy movie where a hobo rides the, you know, a train. Then they get off for a while. Then they get back on. And then they have a fight that's awesome.
I want to see a fan edit. I want to see an hour and a half fan edit.
The Matthew Kumar cut where he's like, oh.
No, it's, you know,
it's
like
the inherent vice of
a hobo
song.
Said he would paint my fence, but then he didn't, you know?
You're going to go softer with it, even though that there's tons of hobo killing
Lee
in
Lee
it?
Marvin told me he would paint my wagon and he didn't.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, well, my name's Justin the Clue, and thank you for listening to Laser Blast Film Society.
Laser focus!
And Dan Gorman, what website do you have to pimp, and what podcast do you have to pimp?
Oh, okay, you can go to modernsuperior.com and listen to a bunch of podcasts. I'm on two of them.
Woo. What are they called?
Time Bandits, and see you next Wednesday.
And they're amazing, much better than this.